Welcome back to the Business Leaders of America podcast, where business leaders come to share their advice and journeys to success with existing and emerging leaders of America. Join us as we delve into the minds of these accomplished individuals, uncovering the strategies and insights that have propelled them to the top. Whether you're an established leader or an emerging force in the business world, this podcast is your go-to source for the knowledge and inspiration needed to navigate the dynamic landscape of American business. Now, here's your host, Dylan Bloyd.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Business Leaders of America podcast. Today, we are honored to host Dr. Maya Zelich, the Dean of the Forbes School of Business and Technology at the University of Arizona Global Campus. With an illustrious career spanning academia, research, and international education, Maya brings a wealth of experience to our discussion. As a Fulbright specialist, Forbes contributor, TEDx speaker, and accomplished author, Maya's insights into leadership, education, and global engagement are unparalleled. From her pioneering work in e-learning development to her extensive research ventures across the globe, she has consistently demonstrated a commitment to excellence and innovation. We'll also explore the genesis of her book, The Power of Perception, and gain insights into her research process. Stay tuned for a thought-provoking conversation with one of the Global 100 inspirational leaders, Dr. Maya Zelich. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Dylan. Really a pleasure being on the show.
Yes, thank you for joining us. All right, so if you could please give us a brief intro on yourself and how you got to where you are today.
Sure. I'm a dean with the Forbes School of Business and Technology. We have approximately 22 programs. We have some undergraduate programs, master's programs, and also two doctoral programs. One of those programs we actually offer to students in China, doctor in management. And one of the programs is a PhD in organizational development and leadership. I actually worked in a corporate setting. I was working in the financial industry for quite some time, went through different layers within that industry, ultimately landed in a corporate training profession, discovered my love for teaching through corporate training. Mm. I went through different ventures, doing corporate and doing teaching part-time, world of academia part-time. And then in 2013, I've made a big decision to move into the world of academia full time, and I've been there ever since. Moved up the ranks of regular faculty position, program chair position, department chair, assistant dean, interim dean, and now dean of the Forbes School of Business and Technology.
Wow, that's amazing. I always like to find out how leaders fall into positions like these, you know, because everyone's is such a different path, and it's so great to hear how you got to where you are today. I also noticed that you're mentioned a little bit earlier that you're a Fulbright specialist, and that's part of the Fulbright specialist program. Can you give us a little background on what that is and what motivated you to participate?
Sure. I was a Fulbright specialist for several years, and with COVID, they actually extended our tenure. So I was a Fulbright specialist. Normal tenure is 3 years. Because of COVID, I think I ended up being a specialist for 5 years. My tenure just expired in October. Mm. I was very fortunate to actually get introduced into that program. And it is a program where they're matching professionals here from the United States. Not necessarily always folks that are in the world of academia, but the majority of them are in the world of academia. Okay. But they can be the experts in their fields. They are matching them up with a host institutions across the world. The goal is usually to be matched with someone with an institution that is in the developing world, because that makes a little bit more sense from mm-hmm. the standpoint of a knowledge exchange and us being able to assist and help and perhaps develop some programs, do some research. So normal tenure that takes one through a 3 years, one is fortunate if they land one project. So I was incredibly blessed. I've done one project as a co-investigator. And two projects as principal investigator. Mm-hmm. So that is actually unusual. So I'm very thankful that I had those opportunities. Two projects were done in Zambia at the Mulungushi University in Kabwe in Zambia. And one project was done in Uganda at the Uganda Management Institute.
Wow.
Those programs are incredibly rewarding. I always say you go there, it's a life-changing opportunity. You learn so much about a particular country, their culture. Also, their educational setting, the environment, some of the opportunities and challenges they're facing as well. You offer what you have in regards to your research, your knowledge. We conducted different seminars, different workshops in both of those countries and have done research ventures. But you also walk away with a completely new sense of understanding of this world and understanding what's happening across the world as far as not only in the world of education, you learn a lot about their business because I'm in the field of business. You learn a lot about their economies, their political, sometimes political settings, sometimes political turmoil, and also a lot of cultural things that you walk away learning.
Yeah, I wasn't very familiar with the program when I was looking into your background and saw that. I was really intrigued, so I started looking a little bit more into it. And it's encouraged to stick around and kind of work with them after the fact, right? Do you still work with those host institutions after you've
Well,
already worked with them?
this is the thing. In Zambia, we've done two projects. I'm still in touch with their former vice chancellor of the Mulungushi University and always welcoming, working, collaborating with her on some other ventures. The other one, I'm still in touch with the host institution. We're in the process of actually doing a research article that is based on the project that we've conducted in Uganda. The one in Zambia resulted in a research article that was already published, but the one in Uganda, we're still working on that research. And we're in touch. One of the things is I consider both sets of members from the host institutions to be dear friends as well. So we're not in touch just as colleagues. You actually, if you're very lucky, and I was incredibly lucky, you walk away having lifelong friends. That's what I have from those experiences.
I'm sure with all the work that you're doing, I'm sure you guys stay in contact for many different situations, many
Yes.
different topics. That's great.
Yes.
How have those international experiences shaped your perspective on education and your approach to leadership in academia?
I've done a lot of research ventures across the world, and I was focusing on the developing world. I've done research in Haiti, done research in Panama, Cuba, Mexico, Middle East, some parts of Africa, and also Europe. I'm actually originally from Europe. Every single experience is eye-opening. I was focusing with my global ventures, not a Fulbright ventures, the global ventures. I was focusing on a particular topic, studying entrepreneurs, small-scale operations that are actually thriving in the setting that is really not welcoming when it comes to one's growth as an entrepreneur. So I was studying the success variables up against all these variables that I called obstacle variables. So I've seen entrepreneurs that are thriving in a political turmoil, in the natural zone disasters, in the settings where there's a lot of different and questionable practices, where they are still somehow able to be successful within the arena of their particular organization. And not only they're successful, they're actually enabling folks to have gainful employment and to thrive as well. So that was my area of focus in Haiti, Cuba, Mexico, Panama, and so forth. So what I've learned is if one is driven, if one has motivation and passion, if one has that passion variable, everything is possible. And also the perception. I've done a lot of work in the field of perception, and you touched upon the book and the research I've done with my co-author, Dr. Diane Hamilton. It is where one person sees a huge obstacle, another one sees an opportunity. And it's not a cliche, it's what you make out of it. And it is your passion, it is your inner drive that is going to take you from point A to point B. And as a leader, if you are not in touch with that passion element, you just have to seek it, and you have to be proactive about it. Many folks are successful when it comes to their title, when it comes to their salaries, but they're not successful when it comes to where they want to be in this world.
Does that translate to you being as a dean in your leadership philosophy at Forbes Business School and Technology?
Yes, I actually always, as I'm interacting with our students, with our faculty, I always, a lot of times when I do one-on-one with faculty, I'm asking them, putting the work aside, day-to-day aside, what is your passion? What gets you going? And if the passion actually also correlates to your daily job, you are a very fortunate person. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. Every single project is not a passion project. I always tease and I say, if you want to destroy me, send me a few Excel spreadsheets. I'm done. That is not my area of passion, but as a dean of a business school, I do realize I have to look at some data, I have to look at some spreadsheets, I have to look at dashboards and the variables and the data points and figure out making data-driven decisions. So absolutely, I have to do that. But then there's interaction with our students. We're about to have students graduate in June, again, another class of students graduating in June. When you see those students walking across the stage, you know, when you interact with those students carrying their babies, they were going to school with their children. We have adult students. Our students are actually already working for the most part. They're raising families, a lot of military students, a lot of students that are actually doing this as their passion on the side after their daily activities, in order to better themselves, to better their family lives, to move up the ladder. So that is the passion of that job, seeing our students succeed. In order to get there, you're going to have to go through some spreadsheets and you have to go through some data points. But that is the area of passion. And as I interact with faculty, as I interact with my students, yes, I ask that question. Because and I always say with students, I say this as well, it's wonderful if you find it at work. Sometimes your life's purpose is not at work. And that is okay. Sometimes you can do both. Sometimes your day job takes you to the path that will be able to fulfill the other needs that you have. And that's when you discover your core purpose.
Yeah, you said something interesting about how there's people who already have families, people are already working in the military. Do you suggest to first get a job before attending the institution?
Not necessarily. It's actually a difficult question, and this is why. The adult education has been created out of necessity for the population of individuals, because who, for one reason or another, were not able to go through the traditional path.
Right.
So I don't know that there is such a thing as you know, what is the best way? The most comfortable way is to leave the comfort of your home. You go to a college dorm. If you're lucky enough, your parents can afford it, or you're able to gain some financial aid, or you're able to get some scholarship. That is probably the easiest way. That is not the way. That is not the choice that the vast majority of our students were ever given, for a variety of reasons. Some of them perhaps had no interest originally, but the vast majority of them didn't have the means to pursue the traditional path. So I think the best way is what you're able to do within the arena of the possibilities given to you in your life. I do feel that the advice that I was giving my son is he went through the traditional path because yet again, he was at a comfort of our home. But I also was suggesting to him to find a job within the area of his pursuit. So right now he's pursuing master's degree while working in the field. Once you reach that master's degree level, I think it's very important to also start working, even if it's an entry level job within your field. Not so much during the undergraduate degree, because we can venture that, you know, to say that a lot of times very young undergraduate students are trying to find themselves. And sometimes they do switch majors, as it happened to many folks that I know.
Right.
And they have the luxury of changing majors. They have the luxury of time. But once you start pursuing a master's degree, it is good to work in your field, if at all possible, because a lot of times once you get that master's degree, as you pursue higher jobs in that field, the very first question is, well, master's degree is great, but you have experience in the field.
And it's so, probably a lot so easier. Oh, go ahead.
The answer is a bit gray answer. It's not like yes or no to your answer, but it's a good question.
Yeah. No, and I completely understand it. It's a lot more relatable. The material is probably a lot more relatable once you've been out in the field. And I have not pursued my master's degree yet, but that's at least what I've heard and discussed with other professionals in your field. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yes. So like if you want to do a master's in media or mass communication, not that you're doing this, or digital, you know, social media, whatever you want to do, you already have this as far as your experience. So sometimes you have experience first and then you steer your master's into direction of your experience, or you're choosing your field and then you try to gain experience as you go along.
Right. That makes total sense. How are you and your colleagues at the Forbes School differentiating from other universities offering business and technology programs? Are you guys doing anything different? Do you discuss with other business deans kind of what they're doing, or do you guys do research on that? How does that work?
Yeah, we're actually interacting with other deans at different conferences, and we're trying to see what the best practices are. We have a particular segment of the market. Our students are adults, as I mentioned, and those are the students that are actually pursuing their education online. We are aligned with the Forbes Media. We have a partnership with Forbes Media for quite some time. So we are focusing on the industry relevance, on the competency modeling in all of our classes. What are we teaching? Is how's that correlated to the current career path? We also have industry board advisors, including the Forbes Board of Advisors, that is looking at our curriculum and actually ensuring that it's applicable, because a lot of times in traditional settings, the world of academia starts getting very, very removed from the world of business. And even if you were incredibly involved in a corporate setting, once you're out of that setting for 5, 6, 7, 10 years, you're not as in tune with what's happening in a particular career. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to come up with a relevant curriculum that is building business leaders of the future, making sure that whatever they're teaching, they're understanding the why behind the content. Younger students don't ask the why behind the content as much. Older students need to know, I'm learning this because of this is what I'm going to do with this particular knowledge at my current workplace or the future workplace. So that is how we're different. And also we're very adaptable. We are revising all of our courses on a 3-year cadence. We are continuously able to update courses with the relevant material. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of courses that have the live feed. So the news is coming into those courses real time. Okay. So our instructors can do a prompt based on something that's happening right now within that particular field.
Wow.
Versus more traditional courses where you create your syllabus at the beginning of the year, you may be very unlikely to change that throughout the year as often as we are able to. So we have that luxury of being able to be agile quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So does that relative material relate to the latest technological advances and staying ahead of that?
Yes. Yes. It's we have tech programs as well, but we're also, for example, you'll see, you probably read that many prestigious traditional schools, their first gut reaction to artificial intelligence, ChatGPT, was to start banning it.
Mm-hmm.
What we've done, our approach was, let's learn all there is to learn about it.
Mm-hmm.
It is not going away. It is the equivalent of banning cell phones when they first came out, banning computers, banning printers when they first came out. It's not
right.
going to happen. Banning cars when they first came out. It's not going to happen. So what we've done is, let's learn it. Let's see what we can do. Yes, there is a concern of suppressing creativity, developing, some of the critics say, intellectual laziness, impacting critical thinking. However, none of those things need to happen. It's how you use it, teaching our students how to use it properly, teaching our faculty how to use it properly. You can provide meaningful feedback to our students, utilizing some of the elements of the artificial intelligence. But a lot of times we tell our students, you have to write your words first.
Mm-hmm.
Gain some ideas, write your words, try to see if it can be polished, then rewrite it again, as opposed to doing a prompt such as, I'm writing a business ethics paper, give me a paper. Well, then all you're doing is basically cheating. So yes, we're continuously trying to implement the newest technology. As a matter of fact, we're doing this podcast right now. We're doing this one course where we're going to have elements of a podcast in a course. And the faculty decided to take an approach of doing some podcasting throughout the course.
Nice.
Very eager to see how that develops. We do have different elements where our students can do portfolio assignments. We have simulations, business simulations. We have legal games, for example.
Mm-hmm.
What I love about simulations and games is there's no such a thing as the right answer. The answer, because in the world of business, you don't always have one answer. What is the best answer under the circumstances? It's driving sometimes folks a little bit crazy.
Yeah.
they're going with that traditional mindset of, what's the right answer?
Yes.
Well, in a business world, you usually have two, three choices. If you only have one choice, that puts you in a very hard position.
Right. Yeah, no, and it absolutely drives creativity, like you mentioned.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I actually had a recent interview where a business dean actually mentioned the similar to what you're saying, is it's not going away. AI is not going away. It's how they foster it and utilize it. But as long as they are making it clear that they are utilizing it in their papers or in their projects, as long as they're stating, they are doing that. But it's when the students are trying to solely rely on the technology is where it kind of ruins it.
Well, the thing is, one of the first things I've done at the ISCB conference last year, I've done a keynote on AI in education. And I was having a great conversation during the keynote and after that keynote from the educators who said that they felt that after my keynote, they will at least give it a try.
Really?
And I basically told them, if you're thinking your students are not using it as we speak, you're basically fooling yourself. They are using it as we speak, which means it's not a matter of whether they're going to use it. They're using it.
Mm-hmm.
So let's start with a basic premise. They're using it. Let's just teach them how to use it.
Mm.
I was also, my son works in the supply chain management industry, and he's working with a lot of different suppliers and the truck drivers and transportation and companies. And I asked him, I said, how many emails do you send with the same theme? Literally the same theme. Your shipment is on its way, your shipment is delayed, some of the same themes. And he gave me like 5-6 themes. Those are the things that are continuously repetitive. You don't need critical thinking when it comes to repetitive things. You can create a few email templates utilizing ChatGPT that you can use for the scenario the shipment is delayed or you're sending something to XYZ point. What I'm trying to say is, let's focus your energy on the things that will make you better at that job. You can have a few email templates, and that is okay.
Right. Yeah, thank you for touching on that. That's kind of my realm as well as the distribution, manufacturing industries, and you're exactly right. Emails like that and being able to utilize AI to help streamline that a little more instead of having to go back to your office every second to send it and then go back. I mean, you're 100% right. That is perfect. Thank you for touching on that.
No problem. I was working in the mortgage industry way back in the day, and we had clients, and when you talk about themes, maybe 12 themes, your appraisal came in low. Everyone thinks their house is worth more than what it is, sadly. And then you have to explain, and we were doing it manually. Every single email was different. We have to explain to this client why their appraisal came lower than what they anticipated. What is the appraiser looking at, the comparable properties, and so forth. I cannot even begin to tell you, you spend hours doing that. Can you imagine now? I would go, if I was in the mortgage industry right now, I would go into ChatGPT saying, give me a good email, client's appraisal, John Smith, appraisal came in 20,000 below what he estimated, and give me a good explanation as to why, considering those comparables. Bam, that email's done. And you can move on to some other things, close some loans, get those mortgages to the closing table, you know.
No, absolutely. It's definitely improved on the productivity side of things. You're absolutely right. I did want to shift gears a little bit. I did want to talk about your book, The Power of Perception. I know you touched on it a little bit earlier, but I did want to ask how that did come to fruition, and can you share a little bit of some insights on your research process behind the book?
Sure, I've shared in a few different venues. So to summarize and make it really quick, a colleague of mine, Diane Hamilton, and I, we were in the same meeting, and we walked away from that meeting with a vastly different perception what that meeting was all about. Absolutely, vastly different perception, and we started teasing each other, and then we started figuring out we are, well educated, hopefully, fairly smart, again, hopefully, and both women, similar. But we were trying to figure out why are we walking away from the same message with such a vastly different perception. And then we started studying different things that are impacting perception. Your culture, your background, your life experiences, your gender, your emotional intelligence, your intelligence. So we were doing a completely research-driven study first of all the variables that are impacting perception. And then we realized that no one's going to read an academic research paper on that other than our fellow professors. And any one of the things that academic research is read by any other population segments, they are misleading themselves, other than students when they're forced to. So what we said, let's put this in writing. Let's put it in a very conversational, easy to digest format for the business leaders to read. What can they do to get from point A to point B, or people that are not even leaders, that are emerging leaders, in order to compete globally? So we put that all together. We came up with the epic process, how to go through the different steps of perceiving the reality and get as aligned as possible, get business reality as aligned as possible to that ever fluid concept of reality. And we talked about how that is a desired concept. That is not something, because your reality and my reality, for example, you may think this call is going really well. I may think it's going horribly. Hopefully, we're very aligned. Hopefully, we think it's going okay. Does that make sense? Now you might have had a horrible day, and you might have come to interview me. You couldn't care less about what I'm talking about. So what I'm saying is not really impacting your perception. It's what happened to you prior to this meeting that is impacting it. So that's kind of the core concept of the book. We've done research, we've done different workshops. We're working with companies that are actually utilizing it in order to motivate their employees, actually assess what motivates their employees depending upon how they perceive reality.
Wow. Oh, thank you for that. Yeah, it's
No
in
problem.
on Amazon, right? Is where they could pick up that book.
Yeah, they can pick up, and I'll send you the link so you can share it with your
Perfect.
viewers. But yes, it is on
Yes,
Amazon. Yes, that is.
absolutely. Yeah, and any for the listeners who are want a little more information on the epic process, go to Maya's website. She has a wonderful video on there who and she does go a little more into detail on that epic process. I just listened to that.
Yeah, I've done a TEDx on that, so that
Wow.
was a good opportunity to share that with the audience as well.
For sure. I do have one last question before we go. And thank you again so much for all your insight and spending time with us today. So, what role does continuous learning play in effective leadership, and how can future leaders cultivate a commitment on to ongoing education and growth?
Well, what I do is I learn something new every single day. Actually, it was my father who always asked me, I would come back from school, and he was asked, he would always ask me, what have you learned today? What have you gained? What type of knowledge have you gained today? So I learn a lot. I mean, I don't read as much as I used to. I'm listening to a lot of books and I'm listening to a lot of podcasts, as a matter of fact. And sometimes those areas are not necessarily my narrow business arena. A lot of times, as I'm learning, I'm trying to learn about areas that I'm not necessarily a subject matter expert of. I love history. I watch documentaries. I'm constantly learning something new about history, about philosophy, about wellness, mental health, and stuff along those lines. So there's areas. I do feel that when it comes to the concept of learning, it is wonderful to get educated within your area, and you should for your job. But make learning not a task. Let's not make it a chore. Learn about things that you don't know anything about. Learn about the different part of the world, or learn about, just yesterday I was just learning some new things. Even though I feel like I'm a nerd when it comes to history, but I've learned new things yesterday about the Egyptian history that I didn't really realize, because there's always this opportunity. And sometimes if you embrace learning as something, as an experience that can also relax you and make you feel fulfilled, that is why I'm advocating not always learning things that are impacting your job, if that makes sense.